Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome to Arts Roundup, an hour spent with artists and performers and a chance to catch up on arts news and upcoming events in Cambridge. In this edition, artist Gurpan Rao previews her new exhibition opening at King's College. The Gilbert and Sullivan Society bring pianos to the city streets and give a sample of a forthcoming production of Princess Ida. We explore cosy art lock-ins at the Hotbox Cafe as 20 artists launch Drink and Draw. Digital artist David Theobald introduces Deepest Sympathy, his new exhibition at the Ruskin Gallery. And the Adams Family Community Arts and Heritage Project in the Fens gets a lifeline from a local businessman and releases a new documentary film. Memory is probably one of the most powerful and interesting faculties of the mind, and it's where we make sense of our world and is often full of emotions and past wonders that we cling to for a sense of security. But it can be difficult to navigate through what's in there and understand it fully with all its images and recollections of past personal experiences. For artist Gurpan Rao, it makes a fascinating starting point for visual art that seeks to explore and investigate an individual's humanity and what lies submerged in the mind in terms of treasure and resources. Her new public exhibition opens at King's College next week and really has masses of depth, colour and intriguing detail. Here she previews the work. Here with me in the studio is Gurpan Rao, who is opening a new exhibition at King's College. The exhibition opens on November the 5th. It's called Time and Place. What's it about?
Simon, this is all about my art that's been done over the years, influenced by all the places I've lived in and different countries. So it's sort of trying to connect my impressions and recollections of and memories of places I've lived in.
You've lived in some quite incredible places, haven't you? You've been in America, in California, in Illinois, Paris, New Delhi. So you have a fantastically cosmopolitan profile, don't you?
Yes, I do like to think of myself as a global, very global sort of person. I have lived in six different countries, actually, and they've all been fantastic experiences.
Now, originally, you studied art in Paris, didn't you? Does that experience live up to its expectations? I mean, it's a very romantic image, isn't it? Studying art in Paris
and
then becoming an artist internationally. I mean, what were your formative years like in Paris when you were studying there?
Well, I was actually, the art I studied in Paris was short courses at the École des Beaux-Arts. Before that, I had my foundations all in India, my art. And then I did my master's in the US. So, of course, Paris was a dream place to do art. You know, we all grow up with this beautiful image of it. So it was lovely, yes.
How would you describe your paintings? And they're wonderfully colourful. As we were saying a little bit earlier, that they have these wonderful colours of India kind of in the subconscious somewhere. How would you describe them to someone?
I'm all over the place. I have lots of different styles. Mm. I do lots of different kinds of work, which I like so many different styles. But the latest ones, the latest body of work, which is all about mapping memories, is all about maps and my whole way of trying to show the world as one.
Do you seek to kind of discover a kind of a frame of reference in terms of memories and experiences and things that people draw upon as they develop as human beings and travel through life? Is that what it's about? It's about mapping that experience?
It is, absolutely, yeah. Simon. Yes, it is. It's recollections and showing them things that are sort of in my subconscious, like every place has left its trace in my memory.
And what are your main influences and inspirations, as it were, for creating these images, which we'll talk about in just a minute?
Well, it's mostly the travels and all the places I've been to. I get very inspired by that, and also humanity.
We're going to talk about some of the ones that you've done in the past. You've obviously a string of very prestigious exhibitions, masses and masses of them. This is coming up to your latest one. But mapping memory, what is that about exactly?
Well, that's all about my recollections of places that I've lived in. What I do is I use maps as my matrix. I cut them up and mix and reunite them, because I'm against borders, I'm against boundaries. So I mix them up in a way to de-emphasize their political meaning and then paint over them.
Are these both good and bad memories? Or?
Actually, they're mostly all good, because I can't remember having any really bad memories anywhere.
And do they depict sort of moods or particular kinds of expression, would you say? Or?
Actually, a lot of them are sort of in layers. They're very layered. They're layers and layers of paint. And then sort of, it's more like weathered walls. And the more you scratch through the surface, you see different things beneath.
I noticed that there are landscapes contained with captured in those images. I mean, you have things that look like trees and branches, even maps and rivers. And they kind of, they're in the image, but they're also melded with what looks like dreams and memories. You have one called Rootless Roaming. How do those come about?
Well, as you said, they are a lot about landscapes, and they're also a lot about the macrocosm and the microcosm, because I see maps to me look like trees, and then they look like veins as well, and arteries. So that whole idea fascinates me.
Now, there's one image which I particularly like called Where Will I Nest Tonight? And it's a picture that, when you first look at it, it perhaps looks like it, what could be lilies on water, but in fact, it's a series of bird's nests, isn't it? Where
Absolutely.
Did that come from? That looks like a very exotic image.
Well, thank you. That's actually, as I, a lot of, you'll see a lot of symbols of shelter recurring through my paintings, because it's this constant search for home with all my traveling and my nomadic gypsy-like life, that their homes, their nests, their rooftops, their all kinds of symbols of shelter, and that's where the nests came from.
Now, you work with these, that they're sort of grids and straight lines, and in a way, it's rather like looking at northings and eastings on a map reference, isn't it? I mean, you do use grids in your work quite a bit. How does that sort of tie in with what you're doing?
That's really interesting that you notice that. It's sort of a subconscious thing that happens. I don't try to do it that way. But I think I do love the grid. I absolutely love the formation of a grid, and it does sort of tie in with my moving around.
Is it about, in a way, kind of trying to mentally measure something or make sense of things with a kind of a blueprint or a frame of reference or something like that?
Absolutely, right? Absolutely. You said it. Blueprint is really one, is really it.
I mean, you're using these fabulous colours, which obviously have that Indian feel, that they come from India. They're very, very bright. But you also have things like links, symbols, and rings, which all seem slightly mysterious, but also they seem to have some significance. How did those arise?
Yeah, the rings are very symbolic. I like the circle. The circle means a lot to me. It's very symbolic in my art. You'll always find a circle in every painting, because it means infinity. There's no beginning and there's no end. And I also it also mimics the cellular structure. So that's where it comes
Does
from.
Does that have religious connotations as well, from India's sort of notions about, you know, patterns in life and things? Because I notice in the Lama series, you have images of what seem to be monks crossing landscapes and things like that. Did you spend some time in Tibet?
Yes, I did. I travelled in Bhutan, actually, and that's where that series was inspired from. The monks, the Tibetan monks, they're just absolutely gorgeous human beings, and they have this aura of peace around them. And these were built around them. And of course, the circle is very symbolic in Zen Buddhism.
They're fantastically interesting, aren't they? Because effectively, they just sort of reject the realities that other people live in. They live within their own world, which is very kind of spiritual, it's peaceful, it's bright, and it's interesting. So, I mean, do you believe in the power of their religion at all? Or?
I do, because I think Buddhism is really one of the religions that appeals to me a lot. It's so about Tibet. Bhutan believes in gross national happiness, which is so joyful and, you know, really, really sort of speaks to my heart.
Did you ever get the chance to meet the Dalai Lama at all when you were in Tibet?
I've actually seen him. No, I didn't meet him there, but I've actually seen him talk in the US, of course.
Okay, so I mean they're very, very tasteful images of Tibetan monks. And then
you.
Nexus 6, which is looks, it's like these are heads of people. They're like photographic negatives. They could possibly be good or they could be bad. They're mysterious. What's that all about?
That whole series of work called Nexus was all built around the DNA knot.
Yeah.
And they are actually all based on negatives, images of human, of people of different ethnic groups that I took myself photographs. And I'm sort of trying to reference human skin and binding membranes by using encaustic in those pieces. And those are knot formations that are actually in our DNA. So I'm trying to say that we're all so much alike. We're 99.9%. Our DNA is the same with all of us. And why are we killing each other? So in that little way, I am trying to make that whole message of, you know.
It seems modern, but also possibly slightly futuristic, some of those. I mean, the people, who were they and where did you find them?
They were people across the university campus that I took pictures of.
Yeah.
And that whole body of work is at the Opus Gallery at the moment in Newcastle. So they're actually paintings, mixed media paintings on wood.
Mm-hmm. And why does skin and membranes as a sort of something that we all share? Is that it?
Yes, exactly. And down to the cellular structure, the circle, and
Okay. Now I had a look also at digital layerings, which were a series of paintings which looked to me rather like looking down on. A landscape, as you might from a plane, into water, and that there are things embedded. It's like looking, if you looked at a beach from above, that you have the natural bottom behind it, and then you have things that are actually submerged in those pictures. What are you trying to do there?
Well, that's very interesting to hear you say that, Simon, because those were photographs taken when I was in Bali, and I've superimposed them over other pieces of my work. So they're sort of paddy fields, but yet they also look like formations on a butterfly's wing. So again, it's back to that whole thing of the macrocosm and the microcosm. And that totally fascinates me.
Now you use a concept of what lies beneath is important in your work, isn't it? It's about really looking at something, isn't it? Rather than, or finding something further than what apparently meets the eye. Is that something you've done a lot of work?
Yes, I usually have, because everything's in layers, and I feel it's almost like an onion as you're peeling it. You know, you really get to the depth of things when you've scratched away from the surface, and that's what I try to do in my painting.
What's your latest batch of work? What does that contain?
Oh, the time and place series. It's all about, it's again, it's underlying maps on the bottom, and then it's got layers and layers of paint, and it's showing, it's recollections of memories from every place I might have visited that's sort of subliminal. So again, it's under the skin, but I use lots of layers because I'm trying to show the passage of time.
Mm-hmm.
And they're recollections of different places, and sometimes there are lots of places in the same piece. So that's what that's about, and the way time has passed, and in my nomadic life again, head somewhere, and then they resurface when I start working with paint.
Now, you use materials like wax, don't you? How do you build one of these wonderful pieces of art?
Well, I use wax mixed with resin, which is a very, very... The Greeks and the Egyptians used that in the 5th century BC. It's an old thing called encaustic. I don't use it anymore because it's very toxic, but you have to heat it to very high temperatures and work with it very fast because it dries instantly.
It gives you wonderful lines that sort of go across the images, but they provide It's like a phosphorescence in a way, isn't it?
Going
across the image that's underneath, which is a very interesting idea to sort of put that over the top of something and just set it off.
Absolutely. It's a very tactile medium as well, and I encourage people to touch it because the more you buff it and with the touch of human skin, it sort of glows. So that's why I reference human skin when I'm using that wax.
The veins. That's wonderful. Okay, so you're opening at King's College on November the 5th. Can anybody come along to this exhibition?
Yes, it's open to anyone. I'm there from noon to 5 every day, until the 15th.
So running right through to the 15th?
5th to the 15th.
And which part of King's is it in?
This is at the King's Arts Centre. This is right after you enter the gate. That's and right. You make a left turn, and it's up the A staircase. There'll be arrows showing people where to go.
A fantastic exhibition. I'm sure I can recommend it to anyone having had a look at your paintings. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Simon.
If you're not from Cambridge, you might be forgiven for thinking that we casually leave pianos in half the city's streets in midwinter for people to stop for a tinkle and share a song or two, just as a matter of course. It's a side of the city's life that's proving popular for people of all ages, and the idea for Cam Street Pianos series was borrowed from London and set up by the university's Gilbert and Sullivan Society and the Festival of Ideas to attract people to music and loosen inhibitions about performing in public. Opera singers have long been entertaining in Covent Garden Market, and Cambridge now seems to be following suit. I caught up with members of the current Gilbert and Sullivan Society team at Trinity Hall's music rooms to find out why they did it and what's coming up in the near future.
I'm Lizzie Blackmore. I'm currently serving as chair of Cambridge University Gilbert and Sullivan Society, and I'm a third year historian at Trinity Hall.
I'm Dylan Morris. I'm currently serving as secretary of the CUG Ness Society. I'm also directing Princess Ida. I'm doing an MPhil in history, and I am originally from the other side of the pond.
I'm Alex Shannon, recent graduate, society veteran, and I'm playing the piano today.
I'm Helen Oxenham. I'm singing Ida in this term's production of Princess Ida, and I'm doing a PhD in medieval history at King's.
I'm Cora Hardy. I'm playing Lady Psyche in Princess Ida, and I am a fourth year linguist from Girton.
How did the original idea come up to do Cannes Street Pianos? Where did it originate from?
As I understand it, it was a piece of artwork that originated in London, which has now been taken to Cambridge with joint funding from the Cambridge Festival of Ideas and the Music Faculty Outreach Programme.
What was the basic idea? What were you aiming to do by doing that? I mean, you posited lots of fantastic pianos all around the city and public places, and people are, even this evening, enjoying them. What were you hoping to achieve? Was it to bridge the ambition and reality gap and get people interested in music that weren't there before?
I do think that the pianos are a fantastic way of bringing music to the public and bringing music outside into spaces where you wouldn't usually hear it.
As people who have joined this society, which is a very long-running society in Cambridge University, encourages people above all to sing, do you think that this really changes your life once you become a musician, especially if you haven't been one before? Once you've
So I've basically sung for as long as I can remember singing. But certainly I know plenty of people who come particularly to the Freshers shows, which anyone gets into, at least into the chorus, who have come never having sung, never having been on a stage before, who have had low self-confidence, all these kind of things, who have then been given the opportunity to get up on a stage and sing, and have found it hugely, hugely exciting.
One reason why we were so keen to do some stuff with the street pianos when they did arrive was precisely that we see music as participatory and as a learning experience. And in that, I think our vision of the society and the vision of the Festival of Arts and Ideas with the street pianos really align quite well. That is to say, if we go around in a street piano and just start singing Pinafore, passerby start to notice, and other people sometimes come and join us. We had one cellist from the Clare College Music Society just show up and sing for about sight reading 20 bars of music, and then he had to go. But that sort of participation and that ethos of participation in music really is something that is important to us, as Helen was saying. And so I think why we went and did a sing through around the piano and did several was that we believe in sharing music in the community and in making music into something that people can come and join into, even if they're not initially super confident.
And it's also really, isn't it, about using the public spaces that are in Cambridge, because many of them are wonderful settings, aren't they? And actually getting people a sense of the community, that they can use those more confidently and have less inhibitions, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. This actually wasn't the first impromptu society performance in public space. A few years ago, I remember, we actually managed to make a weekend column in the national paper, not by name, but the columnist mentioned that they'd heard some people in Cambridge as they were sitting on the banks, punting down the river, singing the Gondoliers, and that was us. So we've got a history of using Cambridge's open spaces to spread the musical word.
The great thing about singing is that, I mean, obviously it's much easier if you have the resource of a teacher and a good piano, but it really is something that anyone can do, because, I mean, if you don't have a piano, you can go on YouTube and find a soundtrack and you can just sing. And most people have the internet these days, though I realise not everyone. Or you can just, you know, sing in the shower. It's something really anyone can do, singing.
Okay, now, Cam Street Piano is just one facet of what you're doing. You've got some new stuff coming up. Can you tell me a bit about that?
You were asking about Cambridge-specific locations, and I think Ida fits very well into that. Ida is an opera that was written to deal with the social issues surrounding the founding of the first women's colleges in Britain, and many of the first women's colleges in Britain were founded right here in Cambridge, Newnham and Girton particularly. We have some Girton people and some Newnham people in our cast, which we're very pleased about, and one of the things I decided earliest upon when I was coming up with my general artistic scheme for the show was that we were going to make the most of the Cambridge-specific setting of Ida and try to show how this is an opera about education being done in a university, and particularly an opera about early women's education being done in a university that was a pioneer in early women's education.
So the great thing about the Gilbert and Sullivan Society is, as well as putting shows on together, we've also managed to form some very close friendships within the people that we've met doing so. And so I suppose it's as much a social society as it is a theatrical society. And yeah, we go to the pub, we have sing-throughs.
Okay, now we're going to do a sing-through now, aren't we? Are you going to do a number for me?
Yes, yeah.
We have a couple of numbers for you. One, a bit sort of quite sad and serious. In this number, the princess, Ida, has just learned that she's in danger of losing the control of her university because she's been undermined by one of her head instructors. One of her head professors has sort of convinced and intimidated her her students into betraying her. And she's singing about how all the best laid plans can come to naught. After that, we'll have another slightly more upbeat number in which the lady Psyche, another professor at the university, sings a tongue-in-cheek song about how, given that Darwinian man is descended from an ape, really, he's not much better than an ape at heart.
Fantastic.
Sightly one, the him fell through. For the maid, when his love took form, would shame and express such terror at his monstrous error that he started an apology and made his escape. The picture of a disconcerted ape.
Thank you all very much for a fantastic session. It was really good.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
The opera Princess Ida runs from November the 20th to the 23rd at Fitzwilliam College Auditorium Theatre, and tickets are £9 for adults and £5 for students and children from the ADC Theatre box office. Two complimentary tickets are being offered to Arts Roundup listeners to Princess Ida on Tuesday, November the 20th, if you can answer the following question. Which Gilbert and Sullivan opera character has a name commonly associated with food, and what is it? Email your answer to simon@cambridge105.fm and the first right answer gets them. There's also a gala concert at Sudbury Quay Theatre on December the 2nd, where people are invited to join the GNS in a sing-through and share some mince pies.
A new sound for a new generation. This is Cambridge 105.
A new forum is being launched to bring local artists together to exchange ideas, creative skills and commercial survival skills in a series of cosy winter lock-ins at Cambridge's Hot Numbers Cafe in Gwydir Street. 20 local artists have banded together to take advantage of the Cosy Arts Hub and its big tables for art workshops for the public across a range of disciplines to help people develop art at all levels. Artists Kerry Littlechild and Emmanuel Martin introduced the Dr. Doodley's Drink and Draw series.
Drink and Draw is an artist's social event hosted kindly by Hot Numbers. It's taking place next week, starting Tuesday the 6th. It came about, really, it was Emmanuel's idea. He mentioned it to me in the pub, and I then sort of did the arranging part. Our idea is basically that Romsey in Petersfield houses a large number of artists, well, Cambridge generally does, and we'd like to provide those artists with a forum, hanging out for sharing ideas and skills in a really informal way.
Is it just drawing, or is it other things as well?
Not explicitly drawing. We want to encourage all creative types to come. And the idea of having a theme is at the moment quite loose. It's just an idea. We sort of want to use the event really as a kind of a social informal meetup, a sort of sharing of ideas. What we may do, I mean, we're going to see how it goes, but what we're sort of thinking is that each artist will have a certain specialism that they could share with others. So for instance, Emmanuel is particularly good at fantasy art, and he can share that with the group. And people aren't obliged to do that part of the meetup if they don't want to. But they can equally. So if they want to pick up new skills, or they want to share, I don't know, lessons on what it's like to be a practicing artist, like sharing sort of business knowledge and skills and contacts, that sort of thing. I mean, it's not networking as such. We want to keep it very informal. And the idea kind of is that we would alternate who sort of leads the event so that different skills are shared at each one.
What would a typical drink and draw session involve?
lots of artists will just turn up, get themselves a nice coffee and maybe some food and sit down. And I think, you know, most of us will, well, we all have art in common and being creative in common. So we'd have something to sort of talk about and share. And I think, you know, actually the challenges of being a practicing artist are prevalent. And I think it's important for us to have a forum to discuss that and to share tips really with each other. So we sit down, we have a coffee, we start talking. If there's an artist leading the event, then they sort of give an overview of what they do, and then they perhaps have their sketchbook with them and talk about, you know, what it is, some tips really for what their specialism is. We want to encourage not just practicing artists, but people who want to learn to be a practicing artist or want to try and get into that a bit more. It's definitely open to all age groups, and I think it's a really good way for people who aren't necessarily practicing to sort of learn in an informal setting. So it's not, you know, it's not this intimidating atmosphere of a class necessarily, but it's a way for you to meet artists that are in the area and pick up skills from those artists and, you know, just kind of share ideas really. We set this up really with Hot Numbers, and they are kindly letting us use the venue without a higher fee for November only. Normally they would charge. So really I'm trying to get as many people to come to this as possible, you know, so that we don't have to then each pay to keep it going. Williams Art, coincidentally, Williams Art and Hot Numbers have sort of opened up the archway at this point. So it's becoming more of an art hub anyway.
Emmanuel, can you tell me a little bit about what you do and what your input has been into the drink and draw scheme, as it were?
Well, I mean, I could teach people whatever they want to know. You know, I paint realistically, but I also paint fantasy. But fantasy is based on reality, and teach anything from anatomy to observational drawing, perspective, light, all the fundamentals of traditional art. You know, if you're teaching children, it's just about getting them feeling comfortable and used to things and experimenting with things. But as you go to people with more advanced skills, you know, you focus on them and challenge them, throw new ideas at them, problem solve some of their quandaries. You know, there's some simple ways of looking at things that they may not have done before, but always building confidence in people is and keeping them practicing, you know.
And we'll be looking at a range of different things. I mean, you know, the group of the 20 that have signed up so far, they all have, you know, completely different styles and strengths. And this is just an opportunity for us to kind of share those with each other. You know, if one particular artist is struggling in an area, whether that be, you know, the business side of their practice, or whether that is with a technical part of the drawing or painting, you know, other artists in the room might be able to assist or, you know, share experience.
I mean, my focus is mainly around portraits, and I do live portraits at some of the May Balls and at the market in town, and I'm at the Made It Market in November. So if anyone would like to get in touch because they either want to come or find out more or host an event, they can email me. My email address is misslittlechild@gmail.com, and yeah, just drop us a line, come along.
Ever felt that contemporary life can be like being trapped in a computerised cycle that lacks meaning and focus and perhaps doesn't really progress, but instead just gets more and more pressured and complicated? Artist David Theobald expands upon this theme with a gripping series of computer animations in his new exhibition Deepest Sympathy at the Ruskin Gallery, running until November the 16th. He explained how the work, which employs a measure of black humour, explores feelings thrown up by the mundane world, which is now so tightly controlled by modern technology.
When I look around the world today, and when I was working in finance, and you saw sort of globalisation, which was this sort of expansion of the marketplace into every aspect of our lives, things that we used to do and interact with each other, which were sort of just done as one relationship to another, started to become costed and turned into service level agreements or something. Like you look at any company, your relationship with the IT staff starts to change. And When I look at the contemporary culture, I had a certain view that I felt that we were sort of being sold on this idea of progress, where really what we were just getting was more complexity. And I think that pushed me to start thinking about different ways in which I might express those views, and being an artist seemed one option. And the idea of sensory and quality that you see in individual personal experience, and somehow that seems to be inherently compromised by this incessant march of technology. I know I sound like a Luddite.
No. I mean, you say in your introductory stuff about the illusion of progress being made by the world of the media and the way we're living at the moment. Yeah. What do you actually mean by that?
Well, it's not clear to me that any of it's making people inherently happier, first thing. Second thing is, I think the idea of progress implies some kind of goal. And it comes, you know, it goes right back to the Renaissance and this idea that somehow mankind is here for a purpose and it's moving towards some kind of endpoint or goal. And I think that itself is a false idea. I think really, you know, we're just trying to get along and do the best we can. And some things are useful and some things aren't. Because take technology, for example. It can be very empowering. It can allow you to do things that you couldn't do before. And I'm not against technology, but I resent the way in which technology is packaged and sold to us. This idea of progress, when it's not clear to me that it's doing anything of the sort. In terms of the medium, because I wanted to explore these ideas around technology and contemporary society and progress, it seemed interesting to me to use computers and digital animation as a tool to do this. In a sense, you know, there seemed a certain satisfaction in using technology to attempt to undermine how we use technology and think about it. And further, inherent in technology is this idea of the loop. Many of the films in the show are loops. They're seamless loops. So you're watching a piece of video and the end joins perfectly onto the beginning. So you're not actually sure whether you're watching it from the beginning, the middle, and the end. And depending on where you come in to watch it, you will experience a slightly different version of what you're seeing. Plus, you get this idea of repetition, and you're not quite sure, have I seen this bit before or not? So you get this strange idea of repetition coming into play. And the loop's important to me because, A, it's the control structure which structures most technology that we use. Every computer program is a set of loops. So you could say the technology used to make these animations consists of a set of loops. But secondly, the idea of the loop really permeates every aspect of how we live, how we commute to work, what we do at work. There's an enormous amount of repetition in how we live our daily lives from one week to the next.
Trapped into a round story, as it were.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's something conceptually satisfying in using sort of digital technology to create seamless loops which would explore this idea of what is it to live in contemporary society. And often focusing on those sort of in-between moments, whether I'm stuck on a train or whether I'm in a lift or standing on an escalator. You know, in a sense, a lot of the videos explore sort of the idea of the mezzanine. It's sort of between you've left one place, you're going to another, and you're somehow in this middle space. And I remember when I used to commute, that was the time where I'd think about stuff. A lot of it is focused on pretty mundane things, and that was an intentional, because usually when people use digital animation, you see it as special effects in movies or games on a computer, so it's used to generate spectacle. And again, it seemed interesting to me to say the idea of digital animation, where it takes no more effort to create some hugely spectacular vista than it does a corner shop, and actually use it to focus on what is fairly mundane that we don't normally probably look at, and at the same time inject it with some humour. I don't like art that's too serious, and I think humour is really useful for making people think laterally, because that's how jokes work. If someone makes a pun, it's because it's got two meanings, and it makes you think across. And so I use a lot of humour in my work to try and... I can't say my work is about X. There's stuff I thought about when I made it. What people take from it depends on who they are and what context they bring to bear. But in a sense, what you're doing is just trying to corral together some of your own ideas and materials, and I hope that when someone looks at it, it does something for them.
David Theobald, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much. You found us.
This is Cambridge 105. There's new hope for the future of a fledgling heritage arts project attracting visitors in the Fens after a deal was struck with a local businessman to save an antiquated and history-steeped shop. The project took over the antiquated Adams family shop in the centre of Littleport, and with the help of a collaborative team of artists, local people and school children, has spontaneously created a new arts and heritage hub in the town. The shop's contents, almost perfectly preserved for over a century, contains a wealth of material cataloguing the community's past, but was in danger of running out of money. But now, current owner David Porter, who safeguarded its contents, has agreed a sale to businessman Peter Hoarders in a bid to give the project a real future. Filmmakers Adam Giles and Richard Miller have recently documented the story, and here with artist and playwright founder Jean Rees, talk about its progress. Adam, there is an outhouse here which is featured in the film, right behind you. What is this tale about Oliver Cromwell that you managed to unearth in your film about that?
Well, there is, it's a bit of a standing joke, but the chap that owns the shop here, David Porter, did say that Cromwell may have slept in this barn. Now, there's nobody to prove that, and there's nobody to disprove that, but one thing's for certain, the barn is of the kind of Cromwellian era, so it's of the, you know, the 16th century, and it's a wonderful old barn, and underneath the tin kind of roof that we can see here, there's like herringbone thatch, there's actual thatch underneath that, and it's made of lovely oak kind of beams inside, so it's amazing, absolutely amazing. But this place is just full of history, local history. I mean, there's all manner of things in this in this shop, and all kinds of histories. We've unearthed some really interesting histories. One in particular is to do with Fen skating locally. So this shop used to hold the only franchise for a type of skate called Hagen skate, and all of the local Fen skaters used to come to this shop to buy their skates. So historically, it's very important because of that one thing. I mean, there's many other stories as well, but most of the stories are people reminiscing, you know, people that used to shop here, people that worked here, of course the owners as well. But it was probably one of the main hubs for Littleport. It was a place not only where people shopped and got all of their essential kind of DIY type items from this shop, but it was a place to come and meet people as well. And I think that's how, you know, shops historically were not just a place to shop, but a place to actually go and meet other local people and exchange stories. It was a very important hub. It was probably just as important as the school and the church, you know, the ironmongers. So it was an important part of local history, and I think that's what we show within the documentary, that this was an integral part of the community, and it's a real shame that it's been lost, but hopefully now it's going to be saved as some sort of centre, heritage centre.
Are you a historian yourself, or do you particularly like making historical films?
Well, we really enjoy making this film. Yeah. I mean, this shop is fascinating because it is a time capsule. Oh. You know, the shop hasn't changed in nearly 130 years, so that I think would fascinate anybody.
Yeah, I noticed when it was first opened to the public quite some time ago, half of what was in here hadn't really been discovered or archived or catalogued properly at all, and they were still in the process of sifting through what really was found here in terms of all the material and bringing in the public to try and fill in all the gaps in the knowledge about that. Now, you brought that together into a film. How's the kind of archiving process progressed since then, some 8 or 9 months ago?
Well, the shop is a Pandora's box. Yeah. And as the new stock was being stripped out, the shop started to close. Things were being revealed, and people were coming out of the woodwork from the local community, revealing their stories, their reminiscences about the shop and the people who worked here, because it's been a central part to Littleport life and Fenland life for generations. So by interviewing local people in the community, particularly elderly people in the community, they've been able to bring together stories for us of Fenland skating, of their time when they were shopping here, you know, which could have been lost forever otherwise.
And you've got obviously footage in the film of people doing the Fen skating. That's quite exciting stuff, really, isn't it? It's a sport that there's always been a passion for in this region, isn't there?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's quite unique, you know, and a magical thing, I think, and something that's you know, unique to this area, and probably a lot of people don't know about, you know, that this magical area on the Fens, you know, freezes over and becomes a kind of a wonderland, really, a winter wonderland, where people would go out and the great races that would happen up here, the trains that would come up from King's Cross, specially laid on for people to come up, for Londoners to come up and watch and bet on the skaters who were out in the Fenland.
Now, your film very much covers that there's something interesting in every corner of the shop and the outhouses, but Dean found in one of these outhouses a desk full of letters and correspondence, didn't she, which told the story about
someone, it's like a time capsule story basically about someone's life some time ago. Can you tell me a bit about that story? Is that featured in the film as well?
Well, it is. One particular lady, Doris Elizabeth Adams, who was the last Adams to work in the shop. Yeah. A lot of her, well, she was actually, they think, one of the first girls from Littleport to go to university. She studied botany at university. And a lot of her old school books were found. Correspondence from lecturers at a university. And strangely, I mean, although she went to university and was promised a very promising career in botany, she was actually drawn back to the shop where she spent the rest of her life serving behind the counter.
At the end of the project, we had an evening where we showed the documentary film. It was a packed, you know, it was literally a packed house. There must have been a couple hundred people there. They had the play, they had the model as well. This is the most amazing model that's been created. So it's been really well supported, and it's what it's shown is a lot of people are really quite connected with their history, and we've shown that here in Littleport. I mean, a good example is the documentary. The documentary hasn't only touched local people, we've now produced it to DVD, but Sky have now become interested in airing the documentary on one of their channels. So it's something, I think it's the loss of this type of shop is not just happening here in Littleport, it's happening all around the country. So a lot of people are very connected to what's happening.
We've had so much support from local people, from organisations that we're looking at for support from, and simply the building is so welcoming and so significant that it never loses its treasures and its pleasure in when people come in.
How has the project sort of consolidated and moved on? Because obviously you've now got a film that ties together the whole story beautifully.
It's moved on, I think, principally because the group of people we had working together were very professional. We've stayed friends and we've had regular meetings. We've got a programme of a tour programme for the model and the living memory book. So basically it's goodwill, it's the effort of the people involved originally that's supported, you know, the movement forward.
Now, you wrote a play about a stash of letters which you found here with local school children. How did that go in the end?
It was really well received. The youngsters, there is a record in the Living Memory book of the rehearsal. The play is actually online. It's a YouTube done by one of the youngsters in the play. So it's simply a film of the play. We've had feedback from the young people in the play that they've created friendship groups. They're still meeting. A lot also I've had written references for young people that have had experience with the play.
Now, obviously, anyone who's interested in this can now collect a DVD from the shop, can't they?
Absolutely.
And so that tells the whole story of it for anyone who wants to get involved.
It is. Yeah. It's a beautiful DVD. It is on sale. We will be able to sell it we're selling it at £10 each. It's a long film. It's 45 minutes long. And in December, it's going to be shown on the community channel.
Fantastic. The Family Adams Project going from strength to strength. Thank you very much indeed for talking to me. Thank you.
It's time to take a look at a pick of what's coming up in the coming weeks. The Winter Wordfest Literary Festival kicks off on November the 24th and promises interviews and workshops with media celebrities Andrew Marr, Nick Robinson, Tom Watson and Martin Hickman. Highlight debates focus on insights into the hacking scandal and dilemmas over the current economy. A wide range of subjects will also be covered by guest poets and writers. Actor Rupert Everett plays Oscar Wilde alongside Freddie Fox and Cal McEninch at the Arts Theatre on the 17th with David Hare's The Judas Kiss, followed by Somerset Maugham's The Sacred Flame on the 24th. Cambridge's African Film Festival opens at the Arts Picture House next Saturday with Nairobi Half-Life, a drama of an African actor realising his stage dreams in the country's capital, starring Joseph Wamaru. The Prague Symphony Orchestra plays Smetana, Beethoven, Janacek and Dvorak at the Corn Exchange on Tuesday the 13th, featuring piano soloist Igor Chechuev and conductor Haiku Matthias Foster, promising Czech music at its best. The Anglian Potters shows off its imaginative and fantastic creations in ceramics at the All Saints Church in Jesus Lane, opening on November the 17th, and runs for a month. Mulled wine and mince pies complement a chance to see some quite extraordinary work. A lunchtime talk centred on the life of artist Winfred Nicholson takes a look through Kettles Yard's archive given by Pembroke College's history of art expert Anna Ferrari on November 15th. And that brings us to the end of this edition of Arts Roundup. I'm Simon Burton and I hope you enjoyed the hour.